Welcome to the Histrionics Podcast, where I review pieces of history that aren't very well known or deserve a little more attention. Today I'm going to discuss an advanced ancient artifact discovered on a shipwreck, a strange darkness that covered a vast area of the United States and Canada, and a deranged killer that was turned into a celebrity. May 17, 1902. Greek archaeologist Valerios Stais discovers the Antikythera mechanism, an ancient mechanical analog computer. The Antikythera mechanism is an ancient Greek hand-powered ori, which is a mechanical model of the solar system that illustrates or predicts the relative positions and motions of the planets and moons. The mechanism has been described as the oldest known example of an analog computer used to predict astronomical positions and eclipses decades in advance. On the front face of the mechanism, there is a fixed ring dial representing the 12 zodiac signs, marked off with equal 30-degree sectors. This matched with the Babylonian custom of assigning 1/12 to each zodiac sign equally. Outside that dial is another ring, which is rotatable, marked off with the months and days of the Sothic Egyptian calendar. The months are marked with the Egyptian names for the months, transcribed into the Greek alphabet. The mechanism was operated by turning a small hand crank, which has never been located. The artifact was among wreckage retrieved from a shipwreck off the coast of the Greek island Antikythera in 1901. On May 17, 1902, it was identified by archaeologist Valerios Stais as containing a gear. The device, housed in the remains of a wooden framed case measuring 13.5 by 7 by 3.5 inches, was found as one lump and later separated into three main fragments, which are now divided into 82 separate fragments after conservation efforts. Four of these fragments contain gears, while inscriptions are found on many others. The largest gear is approximately 5 inches in diameter and originally had 223 teeth. Other fragments may still be in storage, undiscovered since their initial recovery. One was discovered in that way in 2005. Of the 82 known fragments, 7 are mechanically significant and contain the majority of the mechanism and inscriptions. There are also 16 smaller parts that contain fractional and incomplete inscriptions. Possible fragments were also found on the sea floor during an expedition by Jacques Cousteau in the 1970s. All known fragments of the mechanism are now kept at the National Archaeological Museum, located in Athens, along with artistic reconstructions and replicas to demonstrate how it may have looked and worked. In 2008, a team from Cardiff University used computer X-ray tomography and high-resolution surface scanning to image inside fragments of the crust-encased mechanism and read the faintest inscriptions that once covered the outer casing of the machine. This suggests it had 37 meshing bronze gears, enabling it to follow the movements of the moon and the sun through the zodiac, to predict eclipses, and to model the irregular orbit of the moon. This motion was studied in the 2nd century BC by astronomer Hipparchus of Rhodes, and it is speculated he may have been consulted in the machine's construction. There is also speculation that a portion of the mechanism is missing that calculated the positions of the 5 classical planets. The instrument is believed to have been designed and constructed by Greek scientists and has been dated to about 87 BC, or between 150 and 100 BC, or 205 BC. It was obviously constructed before the shipwreck, which has been dated by multiple lines of evidence to approximately 70 to 60 BC. In 2022, researchers proposed its initial calibration date, not its construction date, could have been December 23, 178 BC. Other experts propose 204 BC as a more likely calibration date. Machines with similar complexity did not appear again until the astronomical clocks of the 14th century. Captain Demetrius Kontos and a crew of sponge divers from Symi Island discovered the shipwreck in early 1900 and recovered artifacts during their first expedition with the Hellenic Royal Navy in 1900 and 1901. This wreck of a Roman cargo ship was found at a depth of 150 feet. The team retrieved numerous large objects, including bronze and marble statues, pottery, unique glassware, jewelry, coins, and the mechanism. It is unknown how the mechanism came to be on the cargo ship. All of the items retrieved from the wreckage were transferred to the National Museum of Archaeology in Athens for storage and analysis. The mechanism appeared to be a lump of corroded bronze and wood. It went unnoticed for 2 years while museum staff worked on piecing together more obvious treasures, such as the statues. Upon removal from the seawater, the mechanism was not treated, resulting in detrimental changes. On May 17, 1902, archaeologist Valerio Stace found one of the pieces of rock was embedded with a gear wheel. He initially believed that it was an astronomical clock, but most scholars considered that to be impossible and stated that kind of device would be too complex to be constructed during the same period as the other pieces that were discovered. Investigations into the object were dropped until British science historian and Yale University professor Derek Price became interested in 1951. In 1971, Price and Greek nuclear physicist Charalampos Karakalos made X-ray and gamma-ray images of the 82 fragments. Price published a paper on their findings in 1974. Two other searches for items at the wreck site in 2012 and 2015 yielded art objects and a second ship which may or may not be connected with the treasure ship on where the mechanism was found. Also found was a bronze disc with the image of a bull. The disc has four ears, which have holes in them, and it was thought it may have been a cogwheel for the mechanism. Although there is little evidence that it was part of the mechanism, and it's more likely the disc was a decoration for a piece of furniture. The Antikythera mechanism is generally referred to as the first known analog computer. The quality and complexity of the mechanism suggests it probably had undiscovered predecessors during the Hellenistic period. Its construction relied on theories of astronomy and mathematics developed by Greek astronomers during the 2nd century BC. In 2008, research by the Antikythera Mechanism Research Project suggested the concept for the mechanism may have originated in the colonies of Corinth. Syracuse was a colony of Corinth and the home of Archimedes, and the Antikythera Mechanism Research Project argued in 2008 that it might imply a connection with the school of Archimedes. It was demonstrated in 2017 that the calendar on the Metonic spiral is one of the Corinthian type, but cannot be that of Syracuse. Another theory suggests that coins found by Jacques Cousteau at the wreck site in the 1970s date to the time of the device's construction, and suggests that its origin may have been from the ancient Greek city of Pergamon, home of the Library of Pergamum. With its many scrolls of art and science, it was second in importance only to the Library of Alexandria during the Hellenistic period. The ship carrying the device contained vases in the Rhodian style, leading to a hypothesis that it was constructed at a school founded by Stoic philosopher Posidonius. Rhodes was a busy trading port and a center of astronomy and mechanical engineering, home to astronomer Hipparchus, who was active from about 140 to 120 BC. The mechanism uses the Hipparchus theory for the motion of the moon, which suggests he may have designed or been involved with the work. In 2014, a study argued for a new dating of approximately 200 BC, based on identifying the startup date on the Saros dial, as the astronomical lunar month that began shortly after the new moon on April 28, 205 BC. A study in 2017 suggests that the prototype for this device was from Rhodes, but that this particular model was modified for a client in northwestern Greece. Further dives were undertaken in 2014 and 2015, in the hope of discovering more of the mechanism. A 5-year program of investigations began in 2014 and ended in 2019, with a new 5-year session starting in May of 2020. Here's my take on the Antikythera mechanism. The specifics for how this mechanism operated and the pictures of how it looked while it was functional are shocking for that time period. I didn't include a lot of those details because I'm too stupid to understand how it worked, even with an explanation and pictures to reference. I think there are ancient civilizations that reached technological advances we haven't seen before that are still buried in places all across the world. They may not have passed where we are now, but they may have taken a different path and used different methods. May 19th, 1780. An unusual darkening of the sky was observed over the northeastern United States and parts of Canada. New England's dark day occurred when a strange darkening of the daytime sky was observed over the New England states and parts of eastern Canada. The darkness was so complete that candles were used at noon. It did not disperse until the middle of the next night. The darkness was seen at least as far north as Portland, Maine, and extended southwards to New Jersey, but it was not witnessed in Pennsylvania. The earliest report of the darkness came from Rupert, Vermont, where the sun was already obscured at sunrise. The extraordinary darkness came on between the hours of 10 and 11 a.m. in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peak obscurity occurred at about 12 noon, and a heavy overcast remained for the rest of the day. The darkness reportedly reached Barnstable, Massachusetts by 2 p.m., with peak obscurity occurring at 5:30 p.m. Every affected area was engulfed in darkness into the middle of the next night. Roosters crowed, woodcocks whistled, and frogs peeped as if night had fallen at 2 p.m. in Massachusetts. A witness reported that a strong, sooty smell prevailed in the atmosphere, and that rainwater had a light film over it that was made up of particles of burnt leaves and ash. Contemporary reports also indicate that ash and cinders fell on parts of New Hampshire to a depth of 6 inches. For several days before the dark day, the sun, as viewed from New England, appeared to be red, and the sky appeared yellow. While the darkness was present, soot was observed to have collected in rivers and in rainwater, suggesting the presence of smoke. When the night approached, observers saw the moon was also colored red. Rain was coming down over portions of New England on the morning of May 19th, indicating that a cloud cover was present. Since communications technology of the day was primitive, most people found the darkness to be baffling and inexplicable. Many applied religious interpretations to the event, with some even declaring it to be Judgment Day. The likely cause of the dark day was smoke from extensive forest fires, for which there is evidence from the time of the dark day. This smoke was accompanied by thick fog and cloud cover. When a fire does not kill a tree and the tree later grows, scar marks are left in the growth rings. This makes it possible to approximate the date of a past fire. Researchers that examined the tree rings and fire scars on trees in the area saw evidence of a fire in 1780 and attribute that to the dark day. Here's my take on New England's dark day. 1780 was a much different time. 250 years ago, the vast majority of people were very religious. And without having news at your fingertips like we do now, this event would probably rattle me too.
But you know what? We do have a similar situation going on right now. In June of 2023, where wildfires in Canada are creeping down to the northeast United States. But you know what's weird? It was 10 times worse 250 years ago. So I don't think we can blame this one on global warming.
May 21st, 1936. Sada Abe is arrested after wandering the streets of Tokyo for days with her dead lover's severed genitals in her handbag. Her story soon becomes one of Japan's most notorious scandals. Sada Abe was a Japanese geisha and prostitute who strangled and murdered her lover, Kichizo Ishida, on May 18, 1936, before cutting off his penis and testicles and carrying them around with her in her kimono. The story became a national sensation in Japan, acquiring mythic overtones, and has been interpreted by artists, philosophers, novelists, and filmmakers. Sada Abe was the seventh of eight children of Shigeyoshi and Katsu Abe, an upper-middle-class family of tatami mat makers in Tokyo's Kanda neighborhood. Only four of the Abe children survived to adulthood, and of those, Sada was the youngest. Sada's father had been adopted into the Abe family to help with the business, which he eventually inherited. Aged 52 at the time of Sada's birth, Shigeyoshi Abe was described by police as an honest and upright man, who had neither conspicuous vices nor any brushes with the law, although some acquaintances reported him to be somewhat self-centered, with a taste for extravagance. Likewise, Sada's mother had no known legal or moral blemishes on her record. Sada's brother, Shintaro, was known as a womanizer and after his marriage ran away with his parents' money. Her sister, Teruko, was also known to have several lovers. Sada's father sent Teruko to work in a brothel, which was not an uncommon way to punish female sexual promiscuity in Japan, although he soon bought her back. Her past was not considered a hindrance to marriage for those in the middle class at the time, and she soon married. Sada was born in 1905. Her mother doted on Sada and allowed her to do almost whatever she wanted. She encouraged her to take lessons in singing and playing instruments, both activities which at the time were more closely associated with geisha, an often low-class profession, and prostitutes than with classical artistic endeavor. Geisha were considered glamorous celebrities at the time, and Abe herself pursued this image by skipping school for her music lessons and wearing stylish makeup. As family problems over her siblings became more pressing, Sada was often sent out of the house alone. She soon fell in with a group of similar independent teenagers. At the age of 14, during one of her outings with this group, she was raped by one of her acquaintances, a university student. Her parents initially defended and supported her, but she became a difficult teenager. As Abe became more irresponsible and uncontrollable, her parents sold her to a geisha house in 1922, hoping to find her a place in society with some direction. Toku Abe, Sada's older sister, testified that Sada wished to become a geisha. Sada herself, however, claimed that her father made her a geisha as punishment for her promiscuity. Sada's encounter with the geisha world proved to be frustrating and disappointing. To become a true star among geisha required apprenticeship from childhood, with years spent training and studying arts and music. Abe never progressed beyond a low rank, and one of her main duties was to provide sex for clients. She worked for 5 years in this capacity and eventually contracted syphilis. Since this meant she would be required to undergo regular physical exams, just as a legally licensed prostitute would, Abe decided to enter this better-paying profession. She began working as a prostitute in Osaka's famous brothel district, but soon gained a reputation as a troublemaker. She stole money from clients and attempted to leave the brothel several times, but was tracked down by the well-organized legal prostitution system. After 2 years, Sada eventually succeeded in escaping the licensed prostitution system and began working as a waitress. However, not satisfied with the wages, she was soon working as a prostitute again. although now it was unlicensed. Abe's mother died in January of 1933, and Abe traveled to Tokyo to visit her father and her mother's grave. She entered the prostitution market in Tokyo, and while she was there, became a mistress for the first time. When her father became gravely ill in January of 1934, Abe nursed him for 10 days until his death. In October of 1934, Abe was arrested in a police raid on one of the unlicensed brothels at which she was working at the time. Kinosuke Kasahara, a well-connected friend of the brothel owner, arranged for her release. Kasahara was attracted to Abe, finding that she had no debts, and with Abe's agreement, he made her his mistress. He set up a house for Abe in December of 1934 and also provided her with an income. In his deposition to the police, he remembered, "She was really strong, a really powerful woman. Even though I am pretty jaded, she was enough to astound me. She wasn't satisfied unless we did it 2, 3, or 4 times a night. To her, it was unacceptable unless I had my hand on her private parts all night long. At first, it was great, but after a couple weeks, I got a little exhausted." When Abe suggested that Kasahara leave his wife to marry her, he refused. She then asked Kasahara to allow her to take another lover, which he also refused. Their relationship ended, and to escape him, Abe left for Nagoya. Kasahara ended his testimony with an angry remark about Abe. "She is a slut and a whore, and what she has done makes it clear that men should fear her." Likewise, Abe remembered Kasahara in less than flattering terms, saying, "He didn't love me and treated me like an animal. He was the kind of scum who would then plead with me when I said that we should break up." In Nagoya in 1935, again intending to leave the sex industry, Abe began working as a maid at a restaurant. She soon became romantically involved with a customer at the restaurant, Goro Omiya, a professor and banker who aspired to become a member of the Japanese parliament. Knowing that the restaurant would not tolerate a maid having sexual relations with clients, and becoming bored with Nagoya, she returned to Tokyo in June. Omiya met Abe in Tokyo, and finding that she had previously contracted syphilis, paid for her to stay at a hot springs resort from November until January of 1936. In January, Omiya suggested that Abe could become financially independent by opening a small restaurant, and recommended that she should start working as an apprentice in the restaurant business. Back in Tokyo, Abe began work as an apprentice at the Yoshidaya restaurant in February of 1936. The owner of this establishment, Kichizo Ishida, 42 at the time, worked his way up in the business, starting as an apprentice at a restaurant specializing in eel dishes. He opened Yoshidaya in Tokyo's Nakano neighborhood in 1920. When Sada joined his restaurant, Ishida had become known as a womanizer who by that time did little in the way of actually running the restaurant, which had become managed primarily by his wife. Not long after Abe began working at Yoshidaya, Ishida began making advances towards her. Omiya had never satisfied Abe sexually, and she was responsive to Ishida's approaches. In mid-April, Ishida and Abe initiated their sexual relationship inside the restaurant to the accompaniment of a romantic ballad sung by one of the restaurant's geisha. On April 23rd, Abe and Ishida met for a pre-arranged sexual encounter at a tea house, the contemporary equivalent of a cheap hotel. Planning for only a short fling, the couple instead remained in bed for 4 days. On the night of April 27th, they moved to another tea house in the distant neighborhood of Fatako Tamagawa, where they continued to drink and have sex. They continued having sex even as maids entered the room to serve sake. They next moved to the Ogu neighborhood. Ishida did not actually return to his restaurant until the morning of May 8th, after an absence of about 2 weeks. Regarding Ishida, Abe later said, "It is hard to say exactly what was so good about him, but it was impossible to say anything bad about his looks, his attitude, his skill as a lover, the way he expressed his feelings, I had never met such a sexy man. After their two-week encounter ended, Abe became agitated and began drinking excessively. She said that with Ishida, she had come to know true love for the first time in her life, and the thought of Ishida being back with his wife made her intensely jealous. Just over a week before Ishida's eventual death, Sada began to contemplate his murder. On May 9th, she attended a play in which a geisha attacks her lover with a large knife, and she decided to threaten Ishida with a knife at their next meeting. On May 11th, Abe pawned some of her clothing and used the money to buy a kitchen knife. She later described meeting Ishida that night. "I pulled the kitchen knife out of my bag and threatened him, as had been done in the play I saw, saying, 'Kichi, you wore that kimono just to please one of your favorite customers. You bastard, I'll kill you for that.'" She said Ishida was startled and drew away a little, but seemed delighted with it all. Ishida and Abe returned to Ogu, where they remained until his death. During their lovemaking this time, Abe put the knife to the base of Ishida's penis and said she would make sure he would never play around with another woman. Ishida laughed at this. 2 nights into this bout of sex, Abe began choking Ishida, and he told her to continue, saying that this increased his pleasure. She had him do it to her as well. On the evening of May 16th, Abe used her belt to cut off Ishida's breathing during orgasm, and they both enjoyed it. They repeated this for 2 more hours. Once Abe stopped the strangulation, Ishida's face became distorted and would not return to its normal appearance. Ishida took 30 tablets of a sedative to try to soothe his pain. According to Abe, as Ishida started to doze, he told her, "You'll put the cord around my neck and squeeze it again while I'm sleeping, won't you? If you start to strangle me, don't stop, because it's so painful afterwards." Abe commented that she wondered if he actually wanted her to kill him, but on reflection, decided he must have been joking. At about 2 a.m. on May 18th, as Ishida was asleep, Abe wrapped her sash twice around his neck and strangled him to death. She later told police, "After I killed Ishida, I felt totally at ease, as though a heavy burden had been lifted from my shoulders, and I felt a sense of clarity." After lying with Ishida's body for a few hours, she chopped off his dick and balls with a kitchen knife, wrapped them in a magazine cover, and kept them until her arrest 3 days later. With Ishida's blood, she wrote on his left thigh and on the bed sheet, "Sada Ishida no Kichi Futari Kiri," meaning, "We, Sada and Kichi, are alone." After putting on Ishida's underwear, she left the inn at about 8 in the morning, telling the staff not to disturb him. After leaving the inn, Abe met her former lover, Goro Omiya. She repeatedly apologized to him, but Omiya, unaware of the murder, assumed that she was apologizing for having taken another lover. In reality, Abe's apologies were for the damage to his political career that she knew his association with her was bound to cause. After Ishida's body was discovered, a search was launched for Abe, who was now missing. On May 19th, the newspapers picked up the story. Omiya's career was ruined, and Abe's life was under intense public scrutiny from that point forward. The circumstances of Ishida's death immediately caused a national sensation. On May 19th, Abe went shopping and saw a movie. Under a fake name, she checked into a hotel on May 20th, where she had a massage and drank 3 bottles of beer. She spent the day writing farewell letters to Omiya and Ishida. She planned to commit suicide 1 week after the murder and practiced necrophilia. She stated, "I felt attached to Ishida's penis and thought that only after taking leave from it quietly could I then die. I unwrapped the paper holding his genitals and gazed at his penis and scrotum. I put his penis in my mouth and even tried to insert it up inside of me. It didn't work, though I kept trying and trying. Then I decided that I would flee to Osaka, staying with Ishida's penis all the while. In the end, I would jump from a cliff while holding on to his penis." At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, police detectives, who were suspicious of the alias under which Abe had registered, came to her room. Don't be so formal, she told them. You're looking for Sada Abe, right? Well, that's me. I am Sada Abe. When the police were not convinced, she pulled out Ishida's dick and balls as proof. Abe was arrested and interrogated over 8 sessions. When asked why she had severed Ishida's genitalia, Abe replied, "Because I couldn't take his head or body with me. I wanted to take the part of him that brought me back to the most vivid memories." The interrogating officer was struck by Abe's demeanor. He said she immediately became excited and her eyes sparkled in a strange way. Her answer was, "I loved him so much. I wanted him all to myself. But since we were not husband and wife, as long as he lived, he could be embraced by another woman. I knew that if I killed him, no other woman could ever touch him again. So I killed him." Attempting to explain what distinguished Abe's case from over a dozen other similar cases in Japan, William Johnston suggests that this answer is what captured the imagination of the nation. She killed not out of jealousy, but out of love. Mark Schreiber notes that the Sada Abe incident occurred at a time when the Japanese media were preoccupied with extreme political and military troubles, including a looming war in China. He suggests that a sensational sex scandal, such as this, served as a welcome national release from the other disturbing events of the time. The case also struck a chord with the erotic, grotesque nonsense that was popular at the time, and the Sada Abe incident came to represent that genre for years to come. When the details of the crime were made public, rumors began to circulate that Ishida's penis was of extraordinary size. However, the police officer who interrogated Abe after her arrest denied this, saying, "Ishida's was just average. Abe told me, size doesn't make a man in bed. Technique and his desire to please me were what I liked about Ishida." After her arrest, Ishida's penis and testicles were moved to Tokyo University Medical School's Pathology Museum. They were put on public display soon after the end of World War II, but have since disappeared. The first day of Abe's trial was on November 25, 1936, and by 5 a.m., crowds were already gathering to attend. The judge presiding over the trial admitted to being sexually aroused by some of the details involved in the case, yet made sure that the trial was held with the utmost seriousness. Abe made a statement before being sentenced, saying, "The thing I regret most about this incident is that I have come to be misunderstood as some kind of sexual pervert. There had never been a man in my life like Ishida. There were men I liked and with whom I slept without accepting money, but none made me feel the way I did toward him." On December 21st, 1936, Abe was convicted of murder and mutilation of a corpse. Although the prosecution demanded 10 years and Abe claimed that she desired the death penalty, she was only sentenced to 6 years in prison. Her sentence was commuted on November 10, 1940, on the occasion of the 2,600th anniversary celebrations of the mythical founding of Japan, when Emperor Jimmu came to the throne. Abe was released exactly 5 years after the murder on May 17, 1941. The police record of Abe's interrogation and confession became a national bestseller in 1936. Christine Marin puts the national fascination with Abe's story within the context of the poison woman stereotype, a transgressive female character that had first become popular in Japanese serialized novels and stage works in the 1870s. In the wake of the popular poison woman literature, confessional autobiographies by female criminals began appearing in the late 1890s. By the early 1910s, autobiographical writings by criminal women took an unapologetic tone and sometimes included criticisms of Japan and Japanese society. Kenno Suga, who was hanged in 1911 for conspiring to assassinate Emperor Meiji in what was known as the High Treason Incident, wrote openly rebellious essays while in prison. Fumiko Kanenko, who was sentenced to death for plotting to bomb the imperial family, used her notoriety to speak against the imperial system. Abe's confession, in the years since its appearance, became the most circulated female criminal narrative in Japan. Marin points out that Abe, unlike previous criminal autobiographers, stressed her sexuality and the love she felt for her victim. Upon release from prison, Abe assumed an alias. She was the mistress of a man she referred to in her memoirs as Y. When Abe's true identity became known to Y's friends and family, she broke off their relationship. In the aftermath of World War II, wishing to divert public attention from politics and criticism of the occupying authorities, the Yoshida government encouraged a 3S policy: sports, screen, and sex. Pre-war writings, such as the psychological diagnosis of Abe Sada from 1937, depict Abe as an example of the dangers of unbridled female sexuality and as a threat to the patriarchal system. In the post-war era, she was treated as a critic of totalitarianism and a symbol of freedom from oppressive political ideologies. Abe became a popular subject in literature of both high and low quality. Abe wrote her own autobiography, Memoirs of Abe Sada, which was published in 1948. In contrast to Kimura's depiction of her as a pervert, she stressed her love for Ishida. The first edition of the magazine True Story, in January of 1948, featured previously unpublished photos of the incident. Reflecting the change in tone in writings on Abe, the June 1949 issue of Monthly Reader called her a heroine of that time, for following her own desires in a time of false morality and oppression. Abe lived a low-profile life in Tokyo for the next 20 years, and her neighborhood restaurant association gave her a Model Employee Award. More than once during the 1960s, film critic Donald Ritchie describes Abe making a dramatic entrance into a boisterous group of drinkers. She would slowly descend a long staircase that led into the middle of the crowd, fixing a gaze on individuals in her audience. The men in her pub would respond by putting their hands over their crotches and shouting things like, "Hide the knives," and "I'm afraid to go and pee." Abe would slap the banister in anger and stare the crowd into an uncomfortable and complete silence, and only then continue her entrance. Ritchie commented, "She actually choked a man to death and then cut off his member. A chill would follow when Sada Abe slapped your back." The last known photograph of Abe was taken in August of 1969. She disappeared from the public eye in 1970. When the film In the Realm of the Senses was being planned in the mid-1970s, director Nagisa Oshima apparently sought out Abe and, after a long search, found her. Her hair was short and she was staying in a nunnery. Decades after both the incident and her disappearance, Abe continues to draw public interest. Here's my take on Sada Abe. This story, and the reaction from everyone involved, is shocking to me. Multiple people are sentenced to life in prison and put to death for conspiring to commit murder, but she only gets 5 years for actually killing someone. I know the justice system is fucked up everywhere, but I can't make sense of that. I didn't realize Japan glorified mental illness and murderers the same way America does. This deranged bitch was beyond sick in the head and should have never been allowed to see the light of day. The judge presiding over her case actually admitted to being aroused by the details, and I can't wrap my head around that either. And what is this grotesque sexuality genre, whatever the hell it was called? What the fuck is that? Sada Abe was a very sick individual, and her parents completely failed her. If they showed her love instead of whoring her out to brothels, her life may have been much different. Well, thank you everybody for tuning in. Pretty fucked up story, the last one, huh? Anyway, see you next time.